Well, starting today, we will turn from the prophecies of Haggai, found in the final pages of the Old Testament, to the letter of a pastor found near the end of the New. No one knows who wrote Hebrews, but he or she, and scholars regard Paul's co-worker Priscilla as one of the authorial possibilities. He or she had the heart of a shepherd concerned for a flock. The exiles in Haggai's day, like the exiles in Haggai's day, the recipients of Hebrews had begun well, but were in danger of losing their faith. They are exhorted and warned, encouraged by victories in the past and a vision of the future, most of all by a portrait of Christ, grand, authoritative, and beautiful. This letter can be daunting, with references to Israel's history and religious practice. Yet one of the best loved and most accessible chapters of the Bible is the 11th of Hebrews, a great tour of Bible history, telling the faith of our forebears and the faithfulness of God. The 11th chapter of Hebrews is the text that is going to serve as our sermon series for the next number of weeks. We'll go slowly through it and sort of hear the stories of the men and women of faith that are found there. Great, encouraging accounts of the faithfulness of God and the faith of His people. So we'll begin today, however, with some context. We won't launch into the 11th chapter itself until next week, but we will set the context and kind of draw a picture for ourselves that we can use, I hope, to carry with us in each week to follow. The title of today's message comes from a phrase at the end of chapter 10 of Hebrews. Its central word is the word endurance. It's the word hupomone in Greek. And the phrase, you have need of endurance, comes from the end of chapter 10, the context immediately preceding 11, of course. And there's the word is used again at the very end of chapter 11, that is in the first verse of chapter 12. Let me read that for you. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance, there's the word, the race set before us. So at the end of chapter 10, we read that we have need of endurance, and we're going to go back to that paragraph in a few moments and look at it in more detail. And then we hear the great stories, these wonderful accounts of believers who have gone on before us. Enoch and Sarah and Moses and Rahab and David and many more. Great stories of God at work in human lives, lives like ours. And then at the end of all these stories is this sentence in chapter 12. You have need of endurance, run the race before you. Now, there's a visual image that I want to sort us to get here and to kind of hold on to as we continue on in the weeks to come. It's the image of a distance runner. Someone who has begun a race and has run a long race and it has come to a point of struggling, wondering, can I finish? Do I have what it takes to finish the race that I've started? And the runner is, in this case, surrounded by an arena. He's running in a place where there are stands erected around him. And he's probably got sweat in his eyes by now. He can't see individuals quite so well. But he looks up in the stands and he sees what is called here a cloud of witnesses cheering in the stands. In Roman times, they would have been wearing white robes and probably looked something like a cloud. And he looks up and he realizes there's countless people who have run the race before him and finished their race and now are with enthusiasm crying out that this runner will finish as well. A cloud of witnesses cheering in the stands, finish the race, run with endurance. God's call in our life is one he'll complete. So it's that picture that I hope we can hold on to, the thought of beginning and continuing and finally finishing the race, encouraged by all these men and women that we're going to meet in succeeding weeks. They are now, in some mysterious sense, enthusiasts for us, believing in us, telling their story so we can have encouragement in our lives, in our experience. Well, every time I get this picture, every time I read this part of Hebrews and the runner in the stands and the cheers and so on, I'm always put in mind of the Olympic marathon in 1972. And I, of course, remember that I was a young man then, and you know, always have liked the Olympics, and what was watching the Olympics is the Munich Olympics in 72. And what was distinctive about that is Frank Shorter won the Olympic marathon that year. You may have heard of Frank Shorter, perhaps not. That's his picture up there in the front. And he's the first American in nearly 50 years to win the Olympic marathon. So that was a big deal. And he didn't just win it, he crushed the field. He was ahead by more than half a mile, running by himself, way in front of the crowd. Just a heroic effort on his part. And Olympic marathons, maybe others as well, I don't know, but for sure in the Olympics, the way they're set up is you take off from someplace, you run off into the countryside, over hill and dale and through little towns and here and there and wherever, and almost 26 miles later, you come back and run through a tunnel into the Olympic Stadium, and so for the last half mile or so, you're running around the track, and then you complete the marathon race. And, of course, in the stands are thousands of people. They're there for the track and field events, and when the Olympic marathon is being concluded, everything stops, and the crowd is told, Frank Shorter's on, he's nearly won the race, he's coming, and they're waiting. And some goofball, imposter, jumped onto the track and ran out of the tunnel. And, you know, he's acting goofy, waving his arms, doing something. And everybody started booing. All of the people in the stands waiting for their champion to come, they realized it was somebody else, and they started booing. And then Shorter comes out of the tunnel, and everybody's booing. And, you know, eventually they figured out what had happened and started cheering for the guy. But his expectation was this extraordinary race in which he'd outdone everyone. It's just the highlight of his life, and he was being booed. But, again, our experience, of course, is the antithesis of that. We may not be able to see those who cheer for us. In fact, certainly, except in miraculous circumstances, we can't. We can't see the invisible worlds that are aligned on our side. We don't know how much the angels of God and the people of God in mysterious ways, knowing our circumstances, believing in us. There's silence often in our circumstances, maybe even negatives. Like the booing in the Munich Stadium, but in fact, what our text is telling us is there's a great cloud of witnesses cheering for us. They have finished, and we are going to finish as well. God has been faithful and is faithful, and the call He has in our life, He's going to finish. What He begins, He will finish. Well, I want to read, as I said, the last paragraph of chapter 10. This is, again, by way of getting us oriented to start next week in chapter 11. I think you'll see similarities. I mentioned this already, similarities to the period of time that Haggai prophesied in. People who had begun a work and are now discouraged, and whether it'll be finished or not. Is it, you know, should we carry on? Should we quit? How do we think about the world we live in? You'll see similarities when I read this in a moment. But I want to ask you to look at two different phrases. Notice two different phrases in this reading. The first one is the phrase, do not throw away your confidence. Do not abandon something that's valuable. Don't quit as if the confidence, the faithfulness of God, the enterprise we're engaged in isn't worth it anymore and it's discarded. That's phrase one. Don't throw away your confidence. And then at the very end of this paragraph is a reference to shrinking away in fear, pulling back in fear. Two things that we should not allow to have happen to us, throwing away confidence or shrinking back in fear. Well, let me read this, and then we'll come back and look at it in two parts. Hebrews 10:32. But remember the former days when, after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you yourselves have a better possession and a lasting one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. For yet in a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. but my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. To state the obvious, anyone can begin a race. You could run from this end of the room to the back of the room and announce yourself to have begun a race. Anyone can take the first steps. The question increasingly becomes, will we finish the race? Will we keep on with what we've started? And that's kind of the question we're asking by the imagery of this distance running and so on, is are we going to finish the race? Now, physiologists describe a phenomenon that takes place in marathon running, in particular distance running. Obviously, I've never done that, so you're going to have to, take my word that somebody thinks this is true. That the human body can store, especially a well-conditioned athlete, can store enough glycogen so that you can run 20 miles about. And it's very efficient. Glycogen stores energy efficiently in your body, and it burns energy easily, and it's pretty accessible. And you can make your way through this stored energy in your body to about the 20th mile of a race, and then you run out. And then you need another source of energy. You need to start burning other elements of the cells and the kind of the stored energy in your body, and it's a whole different category. And there's a psychological thing that comes in when you realize you can't keep going. You've what they call hit the wall, and a whole different set of circumstances changes. And the Christian life has that trajectory to it in many cases. We start out having a lot of ourselves to offer, a lot of our own strengths, abilities, capabilities, insights into life. And you go about as far as you can with the stuff that's pretty readily accessible, burning it readily, until we get to the point where we realize we can't keep going the way we've been going, that our best efforts aren't good enough. We need another source of strength, of power, than we have drawn on. We come up against difficulties in life that we hadn't expected, we aren't ready for. We require God to intervene because our best use of our best stuff has run out, finally. And I think that's something like the circumstance that these Hebrews were in. They'd begun well. They're in a circumstance now that they had to face honestly, and they had need of God to intervene so that they would finish the race. Well, let's look again in two sections at this text and at some of the particulars. I just want to make some observations. Let me reread beginning at 32. Remember the former days when, after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of suffering, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have a better one, you yourselves have a better possession and a lasting one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. You have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. The first observation I would make about this is what the start of the race looks like. There is a foolish caricature of what it means to be Christian that is fairly widely spoken of in our time, in which the idea of adding God to your life is the idea of you're aiming at whatever you've been aiming at. You have all the same goals and values and hopes and dreams that you've always had in life. And the best thing to do is add God to it, and so you get to your goals more easily. You accomplish what you've always wanted to accomplish, and God comes alongside to partner with you in making you everything that you had decided you already should be and want to be and intend to be. But there's nothing like that in this text, is there? This is describing a race that begins not by staying on the course you were already on, but to use Jesus' imagery, you leave the broad road, the obvious one, the common one, the same goals that everybody else has, the making life better for yourself in every possible way, and you veer off on a narrow track, through a narrow gate, on a harder road. And you make choices that are going to cost you something. And you decide that having the favor of Christ is worth paying something for. And suffering ridicule for, if that's what it takes. And being different. And deciding that righteousness is better than pleasure, if that's the fork, if that's the nature of the fork in the road. That being truthful is better than being applauded. That partnering with people who love God and are in prison and are set aside and are disregarded and are poor, partnering with such people for the Lord's sake is better than attaching myself to the rich and famous and well-promoted in this world. The race begins at a fork in which we decide to go one way for Christ's sake, with His purposes as our goal, with His direction as our path. And these people joyfully began the race. They didn't complain. They were willing to take the hits. The caricature, the false caricature, suggests that, you know, a vital and happy Christian life consists of having children that are always perfect and never give you difficulties and never struggle themselves. And the more godly we are, the more remarkable and beautiful and trouble-free our family lives are. That we get to have more stuff than we used to have. The more God favors us, the more the world favors us, and we get more stuff. And we get to hang around with all the coolest people and the best people, and they think the world of us, of course, and we do of them. And there's no conflict to speak of. And that we sort of draw a picture of the idyllic life, and God accomplishes it for us. There's nothing like that in this text at all. It's the opposite, if anything. We had a visit last week from our friends from Pakistan. And their story is fairly well known in our church, and we got to hear again of choices this couple has made to stay where they are, to walk alongside poor and persecuted Christians in their country, to take supplies into Muslim areas in the midst of the Kashmiri earthquake, where they aren't welcome to come because they're Christians, and yet they come anyway with supplies and help for those who would otherwise reject them. Our friends who were standing here last week, they don't have to live that way. They could emigrate to Britain anytime they want. Our friend standing with the Anglican Church would allow him to take a parish anywhere else in the world in much more congenial circumstances. But I'd rather, they say, stand alongside people who are paying a price because they love Christ and I love them. And if it's difficult, God bless us. He'll walk with us. Liz Thrasher grew up in this church, Elizabeth Thrasher. She's now working with students at Chico State University. And this summer, the project is to take young Christians, those who are new in their faith, and to help them get launched in their Christian life. They're spending the summer in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, living in rundown circumstances, ministering to poor people on the streets in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. Now, you know, you see the advertisements at the end of the Super Bowl, and the MVP comes running off the field. What are you going to do now? You won the Super Bowl. I'm going to Disneyland. You know, if you succeed and start something cool, and you get, you know, reward yourself, go to Disneyland. And these are young Christians who are new in their faith. What do you get to do? Well, we're going to go live in the Tenderloin in some rundown seedy hotel and care about poor people. How do you get launched in the Christian life? It's not by starting out looking for what I can get, but some place to identify with the love of God in a broken world. And these folks did so joyfully. So, it's a good question to ask. Are we running the right race? Have we started the right direction? Have we chosen the narrow track rather than the broad one? The phrase "throw away one's confidence" is one I ask you to focus on, and I'd like just to comment on that briefly. After the glycogen is all burned up, after you've run a long ways and all your stuff is now pretty well used up, and you realize that the whole thing is harder than you wished it was, what do you do then? You know, you'll get the counsel of your friends saying, well, God's ways are not our ways. And you say, oh, yes, you're right. You know, I have these expectations of God's ways. But the tenth time you hear God's ways are not our ways, you get a little tired of it. How come God's ways are not my ways? How come my service has been not noticed and someone else has been applauded? How can I forgive this difficult person not seven times but 70 times seven? How can I continue in circumstances in which there's no prospect that it's going to change? Where I've prayed and prayed and prayed and God apparently hears my prayers, but I don't sense that He's answering them. How do we keep going? Instead of throwing away our confidence, instead of throwing up our hands. That's the question that's being articulated here. There's a great phrase that Paul uses in Galatians. It says, growing weary in well-doing. To have done a good thing, and a good thing, and a good thing. And by now, we're weary of well-doing. And the question is whether, will anything ever change? That's the problem. Now, there's a whole lot of things that we could say and that we ought to say to one another when we feel this way. But this feeling is a real one. A sense that my Christian life has been... that I've been thorough in following the Lord and I'm confused at the way He treats me. The way He does or does not respond to me. And yet, we're running the race. And there are countless thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands that have gone on before and they are saying from the stands, keep going. It's worth it. He will get you through what you have to get through. He is accomplishing His purposes. Nothing has been forgotten. God has not forgotten us. He has not will not forget you. This is part of something good, though you cannot see that it's good. Don't throw away your confidence. Don't quit. And His resources become more evident to us. We realize that there's a different way to live, more dependent on Him, less dependent on us. And we don't. We don't throw away our faith. Don't throw away our confidence. Let me turn to verse 37 and read 37 through 39 and look at this briefly and we'll be done with our setting of the scene, our preparation. Verse 37. For yet in a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay, but my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the persevering of the soul. If the phrase in verse 30, verse 35, do not throw away your confidence. If that phrase is saying life seems to stretch out and it's not going to change, that the problem, the argument we have with God is that He doesn't seem to bring about any good thing even though we are being dedicated and faithful. If that's that problem, there's a different problem here. The idea of shrinking back is shrinking back from something you're afraid of. And what this letter is highlighting here is this is another element of the race, of the Christian life, of the calling of God, is there are some times when we realize what we have to do is finish on this track through this very narrow place, and there's a dark cave on that in that narrow place, and there's a dragon in it. That there is a hard, frightening, difficult, terrible thing in my life that God wants to deal with. And I have wanted everything but to deal with that dragon all my life. And so, you know, our runner is circling around here and there, everything to avoid having to go past the cave. Running in place, doing whatever you can to avoid the responsibility to move past that thing, shrinking back in fear. Knowing that if I actually have to deal with the abuse I suffered at the hand of my relative when I was a child and all that it has done, all the dark stuff it has done to me, if I have to get that out in the open and invite God to walk through that with me, I don't think I can make it. I'd rather not go there. God, don't make me deal with my addiction. don't blow my cover. Nobody knows what I'm like on the inside. And I don't, Lord, please make me have to face it and deal with it and trust you for it and live with my weakness out in the open. Don't make me run past the cave with the dragon in it. But the call here is to not shrink back from what God has for us, to face the thing, whether it's forgiving someone that has ruined your life and the last thing you can imagine yourself doing is forgiving them, but you know the Lord wants you to forgive them, wants you to be free of the thing that's hanging you up. And the requirement here is that in running the race, we not pull back from the scary thing. The scary thing that has sort of kept us from progress. So, again, the imagery here is that the Lord will finish what he begins. We are not, this verse 39 is very important, we are not those who shrink back to destruction, but those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. We are going to make it. That's what this text calls on us to believe. And we will be encouraged to make it because we will hear from those who in every difficult thing we face, somebody has gone on before us and faced it and trusted God and gotten through it, and they are cheering for us, and their testimony will strengthen us for our circumstance. Now, some of you will wonder, why would someone like me be talking about running races, given the body type that we're dealing with here, given the sort of hard to picture me, I think, as sort of having the kind of expertise that I do on running distances. But actually, I have some visual evidence of my history as a runner. And the time I'm thinking of actually occurred many years ago, in 1975. It was the third Sunday in May. I think it was 1975. It was that or one year on either side, but I'm pretty sure Frank Shorter was still the reigning Olympic champion. So it goes back that far. And I was brand new in ministry here, just past being an intern myself, and had been invited to preach at a church in San Francisco on the third Sunday of May. And so I got in a car, and there was a younger guy who was currently an intern in the church, a guy named Steve Roy. He went with me, and we were driving to San Francisco. Now, I'm going to give you a little advertisement for Steve Roy here just at the side. Steve is now a seminary professor in Illinois, and he's just written a great book on the question of the openness of God and that debate. And if you're at all interested in the sovereignty of God and issues surrounding that, it's a book on theology. You should read it. Excellent book, Steve Roy. But anyway, at that point, he was even younger than me, and I was too young to know what I was doing. And I was supposed to preach in this church in San Francisco. And so we're in the car. We got off the freeway, didn't go onto the Bay Bridge, circled around. It's a one-way street going up to Howard Street. I was in the middle lane. There were three lanes. And a cop came out, stopped the car. Two cars pulled up on either side of me, cars behind me. So completely jammed in on a one-way street. And a runner went by. Then three. Then a clump of about eight. And I had this awful feeling. I'm supposed to be at a church about six blocks on the other side of Howard Street, preaching in just a few minutes. And I opened the door and got out, and there was this infinite stream of people. And it was the Beta Breakers. And this cop said, "No, you're not going anywhere," you know. And I, for all I thought, it could be hours. I have no idea. I mean, it was an infinite stream of people. They're all going to have to go by before any cars are going to go across. So I was panicked, and I said, "Here, Steve, you take the car." And I got out. I had this brown suit on with wingtips. You remember wingtips? Shoes, brown suit, tie, bulky Bible, notes. And I'm trying to get across, but I had to run down stream. You know, I had to get in the stream and run for about three blocks in order to get across the stream to get to the other side, and then go like four or five, whatever it was, blocks to this church that was on the other side, sweaty. And I, of course, realized that, that's my history, by the way, as a distance runner. That's the deal. The point, though, is that the Beta Breakers is not a real race, is it? It's a costume party, or an absence of costume party in some cases. But in any case, it's a game. It's a show. It's for fun. It's goofy. And even Olympic marathons, as important as they are in the scheme of things, are not the most important race. There is a race that's important. And it's the one we're describing, in which the Lord lays claim to our life and takes us from the broad road to the narrow road, and gives us goals that are worth having, and a life that is worth living, and persecution that's worth suffering if necessary, and being different and misunderstood, and connecting us to people we would have nothing in common with otherwise. And we're living a life that someday is going to be to His glory, and the honor that will come at the end of that race, when the Lord says, "Well done," to the finishers, is worth everything it will cost in the interim. This is a race that's worth running, that's worth finishing. And I want to finish by a story of a guy named Ron Hasegawa, who I now regard as one of the brothers who is in the stands cheering on those who are left. Frank Shorter is about 6'3", and he's skinny and has a dark mustache, and he's smart, and he's accomplished, and he's in every way, you know, gifted and applauded and accomplished. Ron Hasegawa never made it to 5 feet tall. He got a kidney disease when he was 3 years old, lived his entire life on dialysis, you know, many times during the week, would have to go to at least El Camino Hospital in Mountain View. He came to Christ when he was a teenager, attended this church, was active here over the years and at times in other churches. And the last years of his life, he couldn't get to church much at all. His health failed so badly. Ron, you can tell by his picture, took steroids, part of his illness. His face is puffed up. He was the last person you'd think of as an athlete if you saw him physically. Walk slow, tiny man. But he is, as much as Moses and David and Abraham and Sarah, a hero of the faith who's finished the race. He's such a man. He died a few weeks ago. We had a service for him here. And the people that spoke at his service in his memory were men and women who were from the dialysis unit at El Camino Hospital. One patient in particular, a single mom who's scared to death of her future as her kidneys have failed and she's raising kids. And there's pain involved, and there's fear involved, and there's uncertainty involved. And she said, "The guy that got me through this is Ron Hasegawa. He prayed for me. He talked to me. He believed in me. He helped me understand what I was facing. He knew what was going on. He helped me get through it." Nurses, patients, doctors, these people all came and said, "This man is extraordinary. This is a man whose life has touched others and inspired others. And he's cheering now to inspire us. And his race is finished. And he's heard the Lord say, 'Well done.'" That's what we're going to begin reading the stories of in weeks to come, is well-known Bible names. But we can imagine every not well-known person, the generations of faithful believers who have sometimes faced a dragon. The scariest thing you ever have to do, you have to run by that cave. And you want to shrink back, and the Lord calls you to run by the cave and face the hard thing. Or a life like Ron's, that goes, he's 55 years old when he died. From age 3 to age 55, he was on dialysis. Year after year after year, prayed prayers. We can well assume that God didn't answer the way he wanted them prayed. Is it worth keeping running? Yes. And stories like these in the scriptures, and stories of people we know, that I hope will help us understand and ourselves, and we'll hear their cheers, and we'll trust our Lord, and we'll someday be the ones that will turn and encourage the people coming behind us. I'd like to ask you to stand. We're going to sing together as kind of a close to our message here. So if you'd stand, that would be great.